Thank you so much, Karen and Daniel. A beautiful reminder that God indeed will hold us fast, and a beautiful introduction to our sermon this morning as we jump into the Old Testament and we take a look at the life of Joseph in our new series, Joseph the Dreamer. You know, the story of Joseph has inspired novels, it's inspired oratorios, it's inspired modern-day musicals, but it's much more than dramatic literature. The story of Joseph connects Genesis to Exodus, describing how the children of Israel ended up in Egypt, but it's much more than just an historical record. The story of Joseph is rich in theology. It's going to become very clear to us that God is sovereign in the life of Joseph, in all of world's events. God will fulfill His covenant plans, His covenant promises for His people. He rules and He overrules decisions in order to save a family and to create a nation through whom all peoples of the earth will be blessed. So the story of Joseph is rich in theology and it's full of very practical lessons for us as well. In at least two places, Paul says that the Old Testament, those stories there, serve as examples to us. He says that in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11, where he writes, "These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the culmination of the ages has come." Then also in Romans chapter 15, he says, "For everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through the endurance taught in the Scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope." So that divinely revealed truth in the Old Testament, it's invaluable to us. Those examples are invaluable to us because they teach us and they warn us and they encourage us. And that's the story of Joseph. So valuable for our lives. It's interesting, Karen shared that story of being on the ship. The birth of a giraffe, very similar, an amazing sight to behold. Gary Richmond, author of It's a Jungle Out There, happened to be at a zoo at just the right moment when this amazing interaction between mother and newborn took place. He's standing right next to the zookeeper, and he's got a lot of questions for this guy. The calf's hooves and head are already visible, so he asks, "When is she going to lie down?" The zookeeper answers, "She won't." Well, that's quite a fall to the ground. Isn't somebody going to be ready to catch the calf? The zookeeper responds, "You can try catching it if you want, but that mother's got enough strength in her back legs to kick your head off." Soon the calf's birthed, falls through the air and thumps on the ground and just kind of lies there motionless. And something totally shocking happened. The mother kicks that calf, sends that baby flipping head over hooves. "Why'd she do that?" Gary asked. "She wants it to get up," the zookeeper said. So the newborn giraffe's there just trying to get its bearings and trying to stand up, not able to, and that giraffe sinks back to the ground and boom, the mother kicks it again and sends it flipping head over hooves a second time. Finally, that little calf manages to get an upright stance and get its stability, get up to its feet. And something happened that took Gary's breath away. The mother kicked the calf off its feet, back onto the ground. And before Gary could ask the question, the zookeeper said, "She wants it to remember how it got up. In the wild, if it didn't quickly follow the herd, predators would pick it off." I think all of us here this morning can relate with that little giraffe baby. You know, all of us have been kicked off our feet at one point or another. All of us have been kicked while we were down on the ground. And a lot of us have been kicked by someone who from we expect love and kindness. And there we are being kicked by them. That's Joseph. That's Joseph in our story. Joseph growing up in a dysfunctional family. Yet God's taking those difficult moments in the life of Joseph and teaching him. And he's gaining valuable understanding to live out his life. The life of Joseph in his early days gives us hope through this truth God teaches lifelong lessons through difficult days. So please turn with me to Genesis chapter 37. We're going to be examining verses 1 through 11. And God's going to be teaching Joseph three lessons in his early life. And I believe He wants us to learn those same three lessons this morning. The first lesson is this. He teaches us how to discern. God teaches us how to discern. Look at Genesis 37 and verse 1. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. Let's go ahead and stop there for just a moment. So Jacob's been living in the land of Canaan, the land of his father Isaac, for about 11 years. He's reconciled with his brother Esau. He thinks all that family drama is behind him. Now he's settled into retirement, we might say, and hoping for relative peace in the days ahead. And we know that that's just not going to play out for him as the story unfolds. Verse 2 says, this is the account of Jacob. Or as some of the translations you might be using this morning, these are the generations of Jacob. That phrase there is where we get the title for the book, Genesis. And there are 11 of those statements. These are the generations of all throughout the book of Genesis. So here's another one. These are the generations, or this is the account of Jacob, marking a transition into a new section of the book. But we're going to find out pretty quickly that the lead role belongs to Joseph in chapters 37 through 50. Though Jacob is present, Joseph kind of takes center stage, and his name is mentioned twice as many times as his father Jacob. So we read here in verse 2, this is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. It's interesting here. Joseph really has a wonderful heritage, great lineage, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, a great heritage of the faith. Yet at 17, he finds himself in a really messed up home, just a mixed up family situation. He is the older son of his mother, Rachel. And that's where normalcy ends in our story, because Jacob is a polygamist. He has two wives, Rachel and her older sister, Leah. So Jacob was tricked earlier on in our story here by Laban, the lady's mother or lady's father, tricked into marrying Leah, the older sister, first. But Jacob always loved Rachel more than Leah. Leah would be the first one to give birth. She'd give birth to four sons. Leah gives birth to four sons. Rachel is barren. So you have one wife who is unloved, and you have a wife who is barren. And you can imagine the tension and the difficulties that brought into their home, the jealousy there. So Rachel offers up her maidservant, Bilhah, to Jacob to bear her children. And Bilhah bore two sons, Dan and Naphtali. And when Leah recognized now that she stopped bearing children, she offers up her maidservant, Zilpah, and bears two more sons to Jacob, Gad and Asher. And Leah later would give birth to another two sons. I know, your heads are spinning. Everybody's trying to figure this thing out together this morning. And then later on, the Bible says that God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and opened her womb. And Rachel gave birth to a son and named him Joseph. Later on, Rachel gives birth to Benjamin and dies in childbirth. So there's Joseph's home life. A father, Jacob. A mother, Rachel, who has died in childbirth. He has three stepmoms, 10 stepbrothers, one brother, and one stepsister. That's worthy of an episode of Jerry Springer, if anything is right there. There is no question whatsoever. He had a messed up home life. But God's going to take these difficult days, this difficult home life, all this dysfunction, and He's going to teach him discernment through all of that. So He teaches us how to discern, God does through Joseph, how to discern what is wrong. Notice in our text that Joseph brings a bad report about his four brothers, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, who we just said are Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. So he's out there serving with his older brothers, learning how to tend the sheep. But we're going to find out quickly here that these older brothers are men of bad character, of poor character. And Joseph recognizes what they're doing, and he has the discernment to see it as wrong and evil. And you know, I think we can get the wrong idea about Joseph. I know I've had a wrong thoughts in my mind about him, and God's trying to clarify those things for me. Kind of view him as that annoying younger brother. All right? My older brother, Matt, was the annoying younger brother to my two older sisters. I love how I can do this publicly to my siblings with no recourse from them. That's great. So Matt, he's that kid. He's that annoying younger brother. I can remember my sisters were out skating on a pond near our house, and they're out there just having a good time, Sarah and Amy, and Matt decides, you know what, I'm going to climb up in this tree, and I'm just going to hurl insults at them, you know, like any younger brother would do. So he does. He climbs up the tree and tells them how horrible they are at skating, and they just finally get tired of it, and they take the skates off, they head back up to the house. Well, Matt realizes he can't get down out of the tree. He starts begging my sisters, come on guys, please, please help me. And as any good older sister would do, they said, figure it out yourself, buddy. Figure it out yourself. Good luck with that. So after a few minutes of him just trying to find his way down, he decides to jump. And he jumps out of that tree, hits the ground, puts his knee into his chin, puts his teeth through his lip, and he's off to the ER for stitches. Poor Matt, right? Poor Matt. Matt's that annoying younger brother. You know, we get kind of tempted in this story to view Joseph that way too. One scholar even writes this, God's future agent and mouthpiece in Egypt could hardly make a worse impression on his first appearance. Spoiled brat, talebearer, braggart. Ouch. I believe that that's a wrong impression, a wrong picture of Joseph. I believe that God was developing in Joseph a discernment that would guide him and sustain him all throughout his life. So God teaches him how to discern what is wrong, and he teaches that, us that as well. But he also teaches him how to discern what is right. So Joseph recognizes this wrong and evil behavior. What's he to do? What's he to do? It's not clear in the text here whether Joseph felt compelled to go to his father of his own initiative, or if the father already had some suspicions and he asked for a report about the brothers. But regardless, there are going to be consequences for Joseph if he tells the truth. And you've heard of the saying, snitches get stitches. Well, that's how it plays out, really. That's how it plays out for Joseph in the story. So the father approaches the brothers. Of course, instantly the brothers know Joseph spilled the beans and the drama begins. Back in September of 2006, a high school senior named Matt Atkinson learned about a dark secret from his three friends. In confidence, they told him about their plans to initiate a Columbine-style attack on their school. They told about igniting bombs near bathrooms and setting fire to exits and shooting any of the 1,500 students and staff that they didn't like. Now, for Matt, these confessions created a crisis of conscience. And though the threats were gravely serious, he just wasn't sure if they were genuine. He wasn't sure if they'd act on them. And the fear hit his heart of, can I risk getting all my friends into trouble if this is just some big joke? So he went and sat down and talked to his mom for a while to gain some clarity. And then the next day he went to the vice principal one day before the planned attacks and told the vice principal. The vice principal acts quickly on it. And he goes and informs the authorities. The authorities take the three boys into custody and start searching their homes. And they confirm their suicides there. Suicide notes. and guns and ammunition and gas masks and camouflage. So Matt, as he thinks back on that, he thought, you know, I've done the right thing. I've done the right thing. Because Matt had this proper view of the consequences of inactivity, of not acting, of not stepping up and doing what he knew to be right. He himself said this, if it wasn't true, at least they'd get the help they needed. If I didn't go and they were serious, I couldn't live with that on my conscience. So here we have Joseph, a young man about the same age as Matt Atkinson, about 17 years old. And he's learning to be a man of integrity. He's learning that just to sit in silence, that's cowardice. But to step out in courage and to speak the truth, that's what God's called him to do. So he's learning discernment. He's learning to be a man of integrity. And that integrity leads to a growing animosity in the hearts of his brothers. So this leads us to the next lesson in the early life of Joseph. God teaches us how to deal. First, he teaches us how to deal with the love of a father. Look with me at verse 3. Now Israel, that's Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made him a richly ornamented robe. So here's Joseph. He's the beloved son. And it seems that Jacob has not learned those lessons about the dangers of favoritism from his childhood. If you remember back, there was major sibling rivalry between Jacob and his brother Esau. Jacob was loved by Rebekah because he was a quiet guy and he liked to stick around the home. And then you have his brother Esau is loved by Isaac because he's a hunter and he's a woodsman. And it created incredible tension and troubles in the home. Sibling rivalry there. And then on into his marriage, you see that Jacob loves Rachel more than he loves Leah. And we already heard about all the mess that created. And now these destructive family dynamics are playing out in the lives of his sons. You know, it may be that Joseph is the beloved son because Rachel, the wife whom Jacob truly loved, has died, giving birth to Benjamin. And maybe now Jacob is transferring that love on to Joseph. We don't know, but we do know there's no question that Joseph is the favorite son in Jacob's old age. And it's significant here that Jacob makes a robe for him. You know, in the land of Canaan, a shepherd would typically wear a short sleeve robe, which was short also to allow for ease of movement. Joseph, a shepherd, gets an altogether different article of clothing. His is richly ornamented. And it's not just a fashion statement. This long-sleeved robe really pointed to Joseph, marked him out as the future leader in the home. It was a symbol of prestige, a symbol of leadership and royalty. And that belonged to the firstborn son. And Joseph is the second youngest in the family out of 12. So what all happened here? Well, if you go back in time, Reuben, the true firstborn, he has slept with his father's wife, Bilhah, and he has lost his privilege, that right as the firstborn son. And if we start to think through this a little bit, Laban tricked Jacob into marrying Leah. And the first four sons are the sons of Leah, whom he never intended to marry. The woman he truly loved was Rachel. And the firstborn son to Rachel was Joseph. So you can kind of see in Jacob's mind, try to get all these names straight, in Jacob's mind that Joseph truly is the firstborn, that he deserves this privilege. Regardless of how we look at all those circumstances, here's the truth. God is sovereign, and God recognized Joseph that he was the choice. He was God's choice, because the dreams will clearly support that as we get to that point in our story. So here's Joseph. He gives a bad report. Animosity is growing. Now the father's love for him is greater, and he's got this ornamented robe, and animosity and jealousy, alienation is growing. So Joseph's got to learn how to deal with the hate of a brother. And we can learn that too, how to deal with the hate of a brother. Look at verse 4. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. So you can sense the tension is building. They are so jealous and they hate Joseph so passionately that they cannot even speak a single kind word to him. Joseph's got to notice this. He's got to feel this hatred towards him from his brothers. I read about Barney, the Doberman Pinscher guard dog at a teddy bear museum in Western England. In the summer of 2006, Barney went berserk. He just went crazy and he shredded 100 teddy bears that were on display there. You can see the carnage. One of those teddy bears was Mabel. It was one of Elvis Presley's teddy bears, worth $75,000. That teddy bear had been loaned to the museum by an English aristocrat. What possessed Barney to go berserk? Why did he become so violent and crazy? Well, the dog's handler, Greg West, speculated it could have been jealousy. Because according to West, I was petting Mabel and saying what a nice little teddy bear she was. You can see the photo of the dog there sitting on his haunches, looking very contrite now. No more dogs after that point were ever allowed into the teddy bear museum. But I think about Jacob and Joseph and the brothers are so jealous because of the petting or that special attention that Joseph is getting from his father. Jealousy grows into hatred. And now we've got a serious situation, and the Bible speaks to that in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12. Hatred stirs up conflict, but love covers all wrongs. The brothers fail to deal with their hatred, and then that just continues to grow in their lives. They cannot love Joseph like Jacob loves Joseph. In fact, we're going to see that word hatred over and over again, three different times in just five verses here. Ultimately, that jealousy turned hatred will lead them to conspire to harm Joseph physically. And here we see Joseph as a type of Christ. We'll talk a little bit about this as we move through our series, but Joseph, although the New Testament does not point to Joseph specifically as a type of Christ, throughout Joseph's life we can see the character and we see certain things about him that point to Jesus Christ who would come in the future. Arthur Pink actually cites 101 different connections between Joseph and Jesus. Think about it just in the early life of Joseph here. Joseph was the beloved son of his father Jacob. Jesus is the beloved son of God the Father. Joseph is hated and rejected by his brothers. Jesus later would be hated and rejected by the very people, his own people, his brothers whom he came to save. So Joseph, a type of Christ. And we'll talk more about that as we move through our series. But Joseph here is, he's got to persevere through some difficult times. If anyone could make this statement, Joseph could. You just don't know what I've been through. Man, Joseph could say that. A messed up, dysfunctional family, sin from his brothers, hatred. But he's not going to allow all that mess to deter him from pursuing God and pursuing God's will for his life. So through the life of Joseph, God teaches us how to discern right from wrong, how to deal with the love of a father and hate from a brother. Finally, he teaches us how to dream. Look at verse 5. Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. So we're going to see that this dream is clearly revelation from God about future events. And in a moment, we're going to realize it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know what these dreams are all about. And it really is going to have an impact on the brothers in this story. Although the full significance, the full scope of all this really won't be understood by Joseph or any of them until the end of the story. So through Joseph, we see how to dream with delight. To dream with delight. Look at verse 6. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. So that content of Joseph's first dream, man, that adds fuel to the fire. And the meaning is straightforward. At some point in the future, Joseph will be the superior and the brothers will be the subjects. Again, you might think of Joseph as that bragging little brother, but I really don't see it that way. Think about being around the table at dinner, right? Your younger brother says, "Hey, guess what? Short time, you're going to be bowing down to me, buddy." What'd you do? You'd laugh in his face, right? That would be ridiculous. You'd ridicule him and laugh in his face. And Joseph here, he believes God has spoken to him. He believes that this is God's will for his life. He doesn't attempt to interpret. He doesn't attempt to apply the dream in any way to his brothers. He just shares it with spontaneity and excitement. God has spoken to me. This is his will for my life. And as I think about that a little more, why do the brothers hate him so much? Why not just laugh it off? Why not just say, "Man, you're acting ridiculous. Forget about that." It's because they knew it was true. They really believed that God was speaking to Joseph and they couldn't handle it. They couldn't handle bowing down to him. They couldn't handle Joseph taking that leadership role in the home. I believe Joseph was right in sharing his dream. This is God's will. God is speaking to him. But you know what? That bad report, that love and that robe, now the first dream, the brother's hatred is just boiling over. God teaches us not only how to dream with delight, but also to dream with determination. Look at verse 9. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him. But catch this, his father kept the matter in mind. So the second dream, it brings rebuke from the brothers again, but it also brings rebuke from his father. That sun and moon there, that's Jacob and most likely Leah. Rachel has died in childbirth and most likely Leah has assumed that motherly role for Joseph. So the sun and the moon, Jacob and Leah, the parents, the 11 stars are clearly the 11 brothers. All of them, father and mother, parents, all the brothers, they will all bow down to Joseph. Notice the brothers are jealous. They hate him. But Jacob keeps the matter in mind. He ponders the meaning of the dream because surely he remembers how God spoke to him in times past, and he may indeed be speaking to his son Joseph as well. You know, no one seems to understand God's will and God's plan for Joseph. Just think about the determination it took for him in the face of hatred and jealousy and rebuke to continue dreaming and to continue sharing his dreams with his family. He's all alone with his dreams. And you know, we know the end of the story. Joseph didn't know the end. And that's true for all of us, isn't it? We don't know the end of our stories. We don't know what God's trying to accomplish. You may feel a little bit like Joseph this morning. Maybe there's dysfunction or sin in your past life. Maybe dysfunction surrounds you and your family right now and it's overwhelming to you. You just can't seem to break the cycle. You see it influencing your life and your loved ones and influencing your home. want to encourage you to dream. Dream. Dream with delight. Dream with determination. God has a plan for your life. God designed you for a specific purpose, and He's sovereign. He's in control of all things. He rules over all. But at the very same time, we have free will. We have a choice. We can choose this day whom we will serve. We have a choice. And I don't know what you faced, and I won't sit here in judgment or try to understand or give advice. But I want to encourage you to give the mess to God. Trust God with that mess. Because God can take all those broken pieces and God can create a masterpiece out of it all. And only God can do that. Only God can do that by His grace and by His power. Yield yourself to God and yield yourself to His plans for your lives. He's working. You may not sense it. You may not feel it this morning. But God is at work. And we can jump from the beginning of Joseph's life to the end of his life. We have that freedom this morning. Joseph didn't know. But let's look at the end of his life. Genesis 50 and verse 20. Joseph says to his family, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." That's some good theology. That's some good theology from Joseph. God is sovereign. He rules and He overrules. And then we add to that Paul's statement in Romans chapter 8, where he says, "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. For those God foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters." So in His providence, God is orchestrating every detail of our lives, taking the good and the bad and using those for our eternal good, our eternal benefit, but more importantly, for His great glory as He takes those things and He molds us into the image of His Son. I love the truth. Where sin abounds, grace abounds much more. That's the life of Joseph. By God's grace, that can be the testimony of our lives too, to the glory of God. So in closing, God teaches us lifelong lessons through difficult days. Joseph learned three very important lessons, lessons that are invaluable to us as well. God teaches us how to discern right from wrong, how to deal with love and hate, and how to dream with delight and determination. Let me close with a story this morning. There was a young man from a very impoverished background who wanted something different for his family. And he had a dream. He saved up all that he could and he went deeply into debt to open up a grocery store in the town of New Salem. He had a partner who really had an alcohol problem and the business started to flounder and to fail. And they went so far into the hole that he referred to his debt as the national debt. He gave up on being a successful businessman. It took him 10 years to pay off the debt he accrued through that business, that failed dream. He went into law, then into politics. Then in 1860, Abraham Lincoln was elected President of the United States. In his second inaugural address, Lincoln reflected on how God was at work in the Civil War in ways more mysterious and profound than any human being could fathom. Just think about it. What a loss. What a loss it would have been, not just to him, but to the whole nation, if the doors of that little grocery store in New Salem had remained open. You know, God knows the end from the beginning and the beginning from the end. And He's at work. He's orchestrating every detail of our lives for His glory. And He takes the good and the bad. He redeems the sin and the difficulties and the dysfunction and the failures. And He takes it all and He uses it for our eternal benefit and for His glory. So I want you to be encouraged this morning. God is in complete control of all things as He prepares us to do His will. Let's pray together. Father, thank You for those wonderful stories, those examples in the Old Testament. Thank you for Joseph, for his faith, for his love of you, for his determination to dream and to follow you in life. I pray that we could learn these needed lessons today. Help us to know what is right and how to act appropriately, how to deal with dysfunction and difficulty. And God, help us to dream. Help us to be all that you desire for us to be. Help us to seek your will and your face above all things. Pray that we'd be used for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.